from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, today marks the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, D.C., and Dr. Martin Luther King's history-making I Have a Dream speech. We'll talk to Bay Area residents who attended the march about what that experience was like, how it changed them in the course of the civil rights movement in America, and 50 years later, how different is the state of race relations in this country? Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. 50 years ago today, a quarter of a million people from across the nation went to the nation's capital. The March on Washington, a march for freedom and jobs, turned out to be a pivotal moment for the civil rights movement in the United States and featured the famous I Have a Dream speech delivered by Dr. Martin Luther King. This Forum Hour, we want to look back at the march and its historic significance with a number of those who were there and also turn our attention to the present status of racial progress and the ongoing striving for the fulfillment of Dr. King's dream.
I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will they be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
Let me tell you who is joining us in studio to talk about that dream and to talk about the March on Washington a half century after the fact. Cecil Williams, founder and minister of liberation for Glide Memorial United Methodist Church in San Francisco, is here with us. Welcome, Cecil. Good to have you back.
Thank
you.
Thank you, Michael.
We also have Daphne Muse with us, director emeritus of Mills College Women's Leadership Institute, who was there at the march. Welcome.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning to you. And Michael Nolan here as well in studio, San Francisco promoter and producer who helped to plan and attended the 1963 March on Washington. Welcome, Michael Nolan.
Pleasure to be here, Michael.
Glad to have you all here with us. And Cecil, let's just talk about what it was like for the moment. A quarter of a million people, hot day, lots of celebrities. A day obviously very ensconced and cherished in memory, but also probably the great moment of black-white unity in terms of ending Jim Crow.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. It was an integrated march. It was an integrated protest. There's no doubt about it. It was the largest group of people that I had ever experienced in my life. And I knew that there were a lot of other folks who had not gone through that experience either. So there was some sense of anticipation, of not knowing what was going to happen, but expecting something big would take place, something that would be magnificent that would take place. We wasn't sure, but we at least felt that. I was 26 years old and out of my mind, frankly speaking. Just walking with people from different groups and to experience touching them and being close to them and getting to meet them was just so exciting for me. It lifted me up. I was out of my mind, I'm telling you, you know? And
with
what
euphoria.
Happened? Huh? Euphoria, yeah. Sure.
But you mentioned the integration. I mean, one out of five of those in attendance were white, and there was another march, as you know, much smaller this past Saturday that was organized by Reverend Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton. One in ten were white in that. Any thoughts about that or reflections about that? Significance?
Maybe it has to do with leadership. Maybe it has to do with the times of what has not only taken place, but what may be looked upon as the 21st century, the new the new direction, searching, finding things not as open and as moving as it was at that particular time 50 years ago. The issues may have been curtailed somewhat, but that does not mean that the issues are still not there, and many of them are even more potent at this time.
Oh, we'll talk about that in the course of this hour. I want to get into that. We even have somebody from the Pew Research Center that did a whole demographic trend study on race relations. So Daphne Muse was there as well and gave up a job to go there.
Well, I didn't quite give the job up. I was challenged by my supervisor. But I just want to say before we move forward that in that mix were Native American, Latino, and Asians, not in huge numbers, but they were present. And I think we have to pay respect to the fact that there were people from a number of cultures who took time off from their jobs to attend the march, to participate, and to bring their voices to that table.
It was supposed to be about jobs too, though, wasn't it?
It was supposed to be primarily about jobs and is still about jobs. I was all of 18 years old. I was going into my sophomore year at Fisk. I was positioning myself to become a member of the Foreign Service. I was doing a summer internship at the State Department. This was my second internship there. Basically, I was a clerk, but they called it an internship. Well, I said to my supervisors, the day of the march, I just felt this enormous energy. And I got up from my desk and I said, I'm going to the march. And they said, you will be fired. And I said, I'm going to the march with all the hubris of an 18-year-old. And I went. And I only had 2 weeks left on the job. I did not get fired. But it became crystal clear to me that I was not Foreign Service material and that I did not want to work for the United States State Department. And I didn't really know who Dr. King was in a more empirical sense. I had a notion of who this man was, but I really did not know, even though I was attending a black university in the Deep South. It would be 1964 before my consciousness really elevated. I mean, the march was certainly a stepping stone to that, but that next year, things just really exploded for me, and I really began to understand what it was Dr. King was bringing to the table. I was born and raised in Washington, D.C. We called it up south. My parents came up out of rural Georgia. I had all the different kinds of experiences that came with the manifestation of racial conflict and segregation at that point in time.
Well, we need to mention that the Civil Rights Act was passed in 64, and the year later the Voting Rights Act was passed. So this was a momentous occasion, and the effect of it was extraordinary. Talk about what it was like, though, being there. I mean, people were pretty well-dressed. There was a lot of sense of dignity.
As my daddy would say, people put on the dog and made it bark. I mean, women had on pearls and hats. They were all church-ladied up and pocketbooks. And men had on ties.
But that's who we are.
Yeah.
That's who we are.
And the people came with the highest elevation of their dignity and representation of it. And I think that had a lot to do with the tone and the tenor of people's behavior. And I was just struck by how fancy the women were looking with their hair. And many men also had hats on.
Yeah.
So this was us representing in our finest and at our best aesthetically, morally, intellectually, culturally.
And we have not seen that like again, have we?
No.
In terms of protests or anything of that sort, alas. Michael Nolan, let me bring you into this. And in fact, you were a friend and associate of Bayer Rustin and actually were involved in the whole planning of the march. Martin Luther King, of course, is a central figure in any memory or any testament to the march. But Rustin was really the architect, and there were people like Whitney Young and A. Philip Randolph who played central roles as well and should also be remembered, just like Daphne Muse said, the people of color who were there in support should be remembered. Talk about the role of Rustin, if you would.
I had worked with Byard when I was 22, 50 years ago today. I was a senior at Columbia. But I knew Byard through the pacifist movement. I was active in the War Resisters League. He was executive secretary of the WRL. He was on leave to run the march. And in high school in Brooklyn, I participated in the two youth marches for integrated schools, which Byard directed in 1958 and 59. I'd say a big difference, you brought it up, Michael, and everybody has. There was a movement then, and there isn't a movement today. It's not surprising that there wasn't a big turnout on Saturday. It's interesting about the confrontation Daphne had with her employer. The strategist wisely decided that the demonstration would not be on a Saturday, it would be on a Wednesday, so that people had to confront their employer and say, I'm going. Are you with me or against me? So a big difference, I would say, is just ideology, strategy, and organization. The Grand Alliance that E. Philip Randolph and Byard Rustin put together of religious organizations, labor unions, and civil rights. And we sorely need that today.
Well, speaking of ideology, there were, and don't mean this, you know, to reinvoke any idea of a Red Scare, but a lot of the people who were there were socialists.
Absolutely. And the FBI was having a field day.
They were taking down license plates and numbers like crazy.
And you know, we call the speech one of the greatest speeches ever for the FBI. It was the most infamous speech ever given. And that is the turning point where the FBI labeled Dr. King the most dangerous Negro in America.
Well, that was Hoover, and you know,
Hoover and William Sullivan.
An NPR story just yesterday, and some people may be shocked at this, but there was talk about all these transcripts of conversations, phone conversations that Dr. King had. I mean, it shouldn't be a shock now in light of Edward Snowden and the revelations and the like, but the fact of the matter is that Robert Kennedy was the attorney general who authorized that. It was not
did indeed.
Authorized the wiretaps.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah. We're talking about the March on Washington. Let me open up the phone line. Some of you may actually have been there, and we want to also talk about just how much we've progressed, how much the King dream has become a reality. I also wanted to have you hear a little bit of something that has always moved me, the voice, the great voice of Nina Simone singing about Dr. Martin Luther King.
Day peace would come to earth to stay, and he spread this message all across the land. Turn the other cheek, he'd plead, love thy neighbor was his creed. Pain, humiliation, death, he did not dread. With his Bible at his side, from his foes he did not hide. It's hard to think this great man is dead.
That's Nina Simone singing about Dr. Martin Luther
great
King
selection.
After his,
a
after
great
his
selection.
Death. Thank you. I want to bring Kim Parker into this discussion. She's Associate Director of the Pew Research Center Social and Demographic Trends Project, and the Pew Research Center did really a pretty extensive study about racial attitudes, found among other things that fewer than one in three blacks and slightly less than a half of those whites who were queried feel that the dream has been, and the achievement of the dream or the progress in the dream has been fulfilled. Kim Parker, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, as Michael Nolan said, there is no movement now like there was then, but we've come a long way in a half century. I mean, we have an African-American president. No one would deny that there's been amazing progress. And yet, even though in your study, from what I read, there's general agreement that blacks and whites get along pretty well, especially the younger generation. 7 in 10 blacks and more than 1 in 4 whites seem to feel that the majority of blacks are treated unfairly still.
Yes, there were very large racial gaps on that question. But as you point out, significant shares of whites saw, you know, unfair treatment for blacks in certain realms of life. And that was particularly true when we asked about how blacks are treated compared with whites in the court system and by the police. And we found there are significant minorities of whites and large majorities of whites saying that in the communities where they live, blacks are treated less fairly than whites in those areas. And we asked about other areas as well.
Don't you find a workplace and public schools? And yeah.
Exactly. The workplace, public schools, stores and restaurants. And, you know, we found across the board pretty significant shares of blacks saying that they're treated less fairly than whites. And also, you know, sort of persistent gaps between blacks and whites in terms of the perceptions of that treatment.
And you also discovered that about 80% of those that you queried felt much more or significantly more needs to be done.
Yes, we did. I mean, I think that, you know, our sort of overall takeaway from this was that, you know, we as a society are headed in the right direction. We did find a pretty strong registration that a lot of progress has been made. But then we found, you know, an even larger share of Americans saying that still a lot needs to be done and large racial gaps on both of those questions, with whites, you know, more likely to think that progress has been made and blacks much more likely to say that a lot needs to be done.
And disparities on household wealth, on marriages, and particularly on incarceration was back in 1960, that 5 times the number of black men were likely to be incarcerated. Here it's 50 years later and it's 6 times. That's depressing.
Exactly. Yeah, we did a pretty extensive extensive analysis of demographic data, and we found that, you know, the economic gulf between blacks and whites that was present 50 years ago, unfortunately, largely remains. And in some areas in household income and household wealth, the gap has actually widened over the last 50 years. In some areas, it's been stagnant in home ownership and in poverty levels. But there have definitely been some areas where the gaps have narrowed, and two of those specifically are high school completion rates, where whites and blacks have converged in terms of the share of young people who have completed high school, and also life expectancy. There used to be a larger life expectancy gap between blacks and whites than you see today. So, you know, that was those were a couple of areas where things have actually those gaps have decreased.
Kim Parker, again, is Associate Director of the Pew Research Center's Social and Demographic Trends Project with the Pew Research Center. Thank you for joining us, Kim.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And in fact, you can join us. We invite you to do so if you have some thoughts, some memories about the March on Washington, or if you'd like to lend your voice to just how far this dream has either moved away or toward what Dr. King talked about. And that word trajectory comes to my mind because he spoke, of course, about history having a moral trajectory, which has been echoed by President Obama. You can join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or go to our Facebook page. And Cecil Williams, the fact that we have a black president, I mean, Martin Luther King would have probably looked at that with disbelief. And he'll be speaking later this afternoon at the same spot that is President Obama will be. But I suppose in many respects, it shows how far we've come, and yet here we are hearing how far we haven't come and need to go.
Yeah, because if we don't ever get at the bottom line, mainly, if we don't ever get at the economic situation, mm-hmm. if we don't deal with classism,
thank you.
We still are miles away from having Absolutely. Overcome so many other areas. And if we have overcome so many areas, it is still not where we would like for it to be. See, so I think what we've got to do is be honest about who we are and what we've done and how far we've come. Because we haven't come that far if we still do not deal with the gap that's taking place in regards to the economic situation.
Which is pretty much in line with what Dr. King wanted to impress on those who were there and on the American population and American citizens at the time. Daphne Muse, long way to go. I think we're all in agreement on that. Still
too long way ago, especially given the amount of work, the time, the energy that people have devoted to struggle. And I think the pushback is so fierce because we accomplished a lot more than we realized we did. And the pushback would not be as fierce if we had not. I also want to just circle back to something quickly. Bayard Rustin had a fabulous voice. And in my collection, I have a recording of him doing Elizabethan songs and Negro spirituals. And it's something you can download on iTunes. And I hope some of these young people will take the time to roll it over to their little toony Google whatever thing. And the other thing is that there are people I ended up working with as an activist later in life who were integral in organizing the march. One of them was Cortland Cox. And Cortland was a member of SNCC. And we ended up working together at Drum and Spear Bookstore, which was a radical enclave of activism and literary offerings in Washington, D.C. So out of this movement came some of my primary friendships, which I still hold and cherish to this day, especially many of the members of SNCC, including Gene Wiley, Frank Smith, Judy Richardson, and Florence Tate, all who had background roles related to struggle and some of them with the March on Washington.
You mentioned SNCC, and I think it's significant to recall that things took a different turn under SNCC. There was a lot of fear of Stokely Carmichael and his rhetoric, and there was a lot of fear of Malcolm X. There had been fear with Martin Luther King, too, even, you know, with, as we've said, with Hoover and so forth. But there was suddenly this concern about militancy, especially with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and Stokely Carmichael, but also with Malcolm X. And what we're seeing now, Michael Nolan, I'd like to get your thoughts about this, is in some ways maybe even more troubling polarization. You think about, obviously, the Trayvon Martin case comes immediately to mind, all the concern in the African-American community about that, and, well, throughout many other communities as well. But then there was talk about Christopher Lane, the Australian who was shot out of boredom or
just
whatever.
Just senseless.
Shorty Baldwin. I mean, in other words, these isolated incidents come up in the news, and the news pays so much attention to them and says blacks are doing it to whites are doing it to blacks, and it just increases that sense of gap between the races.
Well, I agree with Cecil and Daphne that the answer lies in basic economic change. And speaking of moral trajectory, I think it's interesting to look at Martin Luther King's moral trajectory in the last 5 years of his life, starting in Selma and then winding up with his Poor People's March and his call for an economic Bill of Rights.
His opposition to Vietnam.
Absolutely.
Breaking with LBJ on Vietnam. Absolutely. And he was moving when he was shot. And he was with the poor sanitation workers in Memphis when he was shot down. I recall I was deeply moved by the Montgomery bus boycott. And I read his book, Stride Toward Freedom, by Martin Luther King. And I remember, being a student of sociology, one citation he made that during the period of that bus boycott instigated by Rosa Parks, that crime within the black community went down because of a greater sense of dignity and community. We also know that race relations improved during World War II when we had full employment. So,
and let me add to that there is a higher unemployment rate among African Americans now. We're coming up on a break, and I want to come back and find out more of what you, our listeners, think. We're talking with Michael Nolan, with Cecil Williams, with Daphne Muse, and spoke earlier with Kim Parker from the Pew Research Center. You are welcome to join us. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us forum at kqed.org. We'd like to hear from you, your thoughts about the March on Washington, your memories of it, but also where we are today. I'm Michael Krasny.
'Cause he'd seen the mountaintop, and he knew he could not stop. Always living with the threat of death ahead. Folks, you'd better is dead.
That again is the great Nina Simone singing in honor of Martin Luther King right after his death, very soon after his death, in fact. And we're talking about really his legacy here. There's no escaping the fact that that dominated and continues to dominate the March on Washington 50 years later. This today actually marks the 50-year anniversary of his history-making I Have a Dream speech, and we're talking to Bay Area residents who attended the march about what the experience was like, how it changed them, and the course of the civil rights movement in America. It was pivotal. And after 50 years, asking the question, how different is the state of race relations in this country, and race relations really being inclusive not only of African Americans, but relations between all of us, whatever color we may be. I was also saying off-air to our guests, Daphne Muse and Michael Nolan and Cecil Williams, how some of you may have heard the story earlier that was reported on NPR about Mahalia Jackson and her role in Dr. King's speech, how she got him essentially off script to give a speech that was without script and that was what they call preaching, as Cecil Williams reminded me, because she said to him, do what you did in Detroit. You know, she gave an I Have a Dream speech earlier in Detroit with Walter Reuther, and there again was that coalition with labor and all of where the movement was moving at the time. Let me bring in and remind you, Cecil Williams here with us in studios, founder and minister of liberation for the Glide Memorial United Church, Methodist Church in San Francisco. Daphne Muse is the director emeritus of the Mills College Women's Leadership Institute, and Michael Nolan is San Francisco promoter and producer and someone who actually helped plan the march in Washington. All of our guests attended that march 50 years ago today, and they're all still pretty young at heart. Let's get Nancy on as our first caller. Good morning.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
I was at the march, and I was living in San Francisco at the time. I was active in Women for Peace, and Women for Peace sent me on the Corps chartered bus. So the peace movement was in on this, as well as the labor movement. It was a big coalition putting this on. And I was kind of appalled to hear or to read that the AP article on the reenactment of the march on Saturday said there were a grab bag of issues presented, including gay rights, global warming, and organized labor. Well, organized labor was one of the engines of the original march, and to say that this is, I mean, to imply that this is sort of a sidetrack, and Bayard Rustin was gay. And we didn't know about global warming then. If we had, that would have been an issue too. So these don't seem like sidetracks to me at all.
All right. Thank you. Any of our panelists want to respond to that? I mean, things did kind of splinter after the March on Washington. A lot was done. It became pivotal, as we said, but there was identity politics and there was other issues such as Vietnam, and so many issues got tied together in many respects.
You know, Michael, I don't see it as splintering. I think this is really tied in to ultimately to the essence of our humanity. I mean, no matter what race, ethnicity we are, if the planet is imploding, it's not going to say, oh, excuse me, you white, I'm not going to take you out. You know, it just doesn't roll like that. And these are things that are integral to the lives of all of us. So I don't see it as splintering, and I'd like for us to look more at how these things are related. And I think a lot of the young people are doing this. I mean, young people are marching all over Facebook. Davy D, Avis DeWeaver Jones, Morning Star Galley. These are young people who are doing some phenomenal organizing and work across gender, race, class. And just because my generation may not have heard of them, it does not mean they don't exist, and it does not mean there's organizing that's not taking place. It is, but it's manifesting in different ways.
Do you dilute things, though, I guess would be the major question here. Because the March on Washington said freedom and jobs. Those were that was the focus, those two things. And now we do try to be much more inclusive, bring in so many more issues, and they're certainly all interrelated. But does it essentially dilute freedom and jobs?
I think people need to look at the ways that, again, how all of those intersect. And the other thing is, we use the words issues a lot, and I just want to be clear. As a Black woman, I am not an issue. I'm not. There are issues that surround my life, but identifying people, identifying Black people as an issue, I am not an issue. Now, I don't know how other Black people feel, but I get offended when someone labels me as an issue. The issue goes back to jobs, economics, racism, classism. Just wanted to make that clear.
Also,
Michael Nolan.
Cecil
Williams. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go on.
I'll go, Nate. Well, I would just
say. You both
say,
want to go. Go ahead.
As a child of the 60s, somebody active in the movement, I took great inspiration by the Occupy movement. I think they really got it in terms of the gross economic inequities that exist in our society.
I agree.
Too bad it was, I guess, created, thought up by a Canadian advertising agency and lacked the grand alliance, the organizational skills of a Bayard Rustin, Martin Luther King, A. Philip Randolph, lacked labor support. But in terms of an inspirational event with a strong, compelling vision, I think Occupy had it. And they talked about that.
I concur.
There were those, you know, it's funny because, again, on NPR earlier this morning, they were interviewing Michelle Norris was interviewing Clarence Jones, and he was talking about how frightened he was that things were going to get out of hand, that there was going to be violence and, you know, anarchy and everything, which unfortunately has happened in conjunction with the Occupy movement. But it didn't happen in Washington in 1963. Things were very peaceful. In fact, I'm looking at a listener who writes, I was a 19-year-old student at UC Berkeley visiting family in New York and took the train to Washington to attend the march. I had no idea at that time that I was participating in such a historic event. It was a beautiful event filled with wonderful people from all over the country sharing common goal. I returned to school with a renewed sense of purpose and social justice, which continues to guide my life. Let us learn from the past 50 years and continue to move forward. And Cecil, you were going to say something.
Yes.
I'm a little closer to Michael.
Okay, thank you. When we look at what occurred after the march on Washington 50 years ago, we have seen, for instance, one group after another that has emerged as came out of that movement. There were many people who were involved and for years organizing not only civil rights but human rights. And a number of groups went into to organize group, like, for instance, the gay and lesbian community. They moved because of the civil rights movement, because of what happened on that day. They began to see that they had to move, do things, because I know I was a part of some of that organizing as well. And what I want to just say is if it doesn't look like people did as much as they could have done and did do, be mindful of the fact that there were a lot of things that did take place that we don't even know about.
Absolutely.
The organizing that we don't even know about.
Absolutely.
It took place. It just happened. That was it. So I accept the fact that it had to split, if you want to call it splinter. It had to. But that, because there were other people who were wanting to do certain things themselves that came out of the civil rights movement.
Well, that the civil rights movement was a catalyst for, as you're saying. Yeah,
very it much certainly so. Was. And that there was a specific set of instructions that the dignity of the race was at hand and that we had to behave at a certain standard. And everybody to a person, did I remember no reports or incidents of people being accosted, assaulted, just the tone in the air was just so absolutely remarkably respectful. I think the other thing for the young people who listen to your show is we didn't tweet. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't text. The technology was very different. So the organizing had a lot to do with feet on the ground.
Yeah.
And we were working person to person and not cell phone to cell phone or email to email. It was a very different way of organizing. And I think that had something to do with the kind of humanity that came up out of it.
Ah, the non-virtual world, how we sometimes long for it. let me actually have you hear another cut from Dr. King's speech.
There are those who are asking the devotees of civil rights, when will you be satisfied? We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. We can never be satisfied. As long as our bodies, heavy with the fatigue of travel, cannot gain lodging in the motels of the highways and the hotels of the cities. We cannot be satisfied as long as the Negro's basic mobility is from a smaller ghetto to a larger one.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. That, again, was the voice of Martin Luther King 50 years ago at the March on Washington. And let me go to more of your calls, and we bring in a caller from San Francisco. Ina, good morning.
Good morning.
You're on the air, Ina.
Oh, okay. Hi. So I was 19 years old, and I was spending the summer at Harvard University at the summer school, and some kids were going down. I needed a ride down to Virginia. And some kids who were politically involved, they were from Berkeley, they were riding down to Washington. So I went with them and decided to go to the march. And it was just a wonderful event. I mean, I think the word dignity that someone used is really the one that that stands out in my mind. I had never been with or met black people, as many black people. My experience was that when I was in the group, I felt that everyone was one. I mean, there was no black and there was no white. And I really think I subsequently became a judge in San Francisco. And, Michael, we'd met before through my husband, Leonard. And I think that, you know, the work that I've done at Juvenile Hall, a lot of that with the kids there has been informed by my experience in Washington that day. And really being with people with so much dignity and such good feelings that it was really inspiring.
Ina, good of you to call and share that with us. Thank you. I want to bring another caller in who was there, and that's Gabriella in Vallejo. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael, and everyone else. My name is Gabriela Milano, and I'm a professional social activist. I'm originally from Uruguay and Argentina, as well as from the United States. I'm a third-generation social activist. I was extremely pleased to hear earlier that a few of your guests were saying it's not that the movements, not only in the United States but in the world, are not there. We are organizing. We're just organizing differently. What's missing from the conversation is the intergenerational aspects that is much more common in places like Africa or Latin America. The United States tends to have a problem in intergenerational approach to social change. That's what we need to listen up to the rest of the world who have been doing it for generations. So I was raised with Dr. Luther King's conversations in my kitchen table, even though I was in Montevideo. Why? Because we cared about the entire world, including the United States. So one of the reasons why there's a leadership gap in the United States is that the older generations tend to, we say in Chile, ningunear, the act of pretending you're not there. And so that's why there's a leadership gap, not because we don't exist, but because we are organizing in different ways. And I so agree that the ethics of the older generations, I'm only 50, okay, so I'm in between. I'm not the older generation. I'm only, not the younger generation. I'm somewhere in between. What's lacking is the combination of the ethics of the organizing that you were just talking about, the sense of urgency, the sense of presence, the sense of you are together, and you will not say that you're going to do something and not do it. That sense of ethics needs to be winded with the technology, because the technology is a great, great, great resource, the best of both worlds. Not throwing the baby with the bathwater.
You make some very good points, Gabriela, and I thank you for that. It certainly was actually a global movement. I think we have to all agree.
Sure.
That Dr. King and the march initiated and was behind. Here's Carol from Walnut Creek, who writes, I find it sad that even though the emphasis this past week or so has been on the Civil Rights March in Washington, no mention of the great Paul Robeson and his struggle to attain civil and worker rights has ever been made from all the news media that I have been listening to. It's an interesting point. Paul Robeson was a remarkable figure. I mean, not only as an actor, as an athlete, but also as a civil rights man who was very involved in the struggle and was sent away from the United States and had to leave here because he was a communist. But there were so many celebrities at this march. I mean, I looked down at the list. Sidney Poitier and Bob Dylan and Charlton Heston and Marlon Brando and Harry Belafonte and Rita Moreno and Paul Newman. I mean, just it's astonishing.
You know, and I didn't know who a single one of them was. I didn't, because we couldn't afford to go to movies. So I didn't know who these movies – I grew up in a working-class family. My father was a butler. And we just – going to the movie was not an option. And we had television, but we didn't watch much of it. So I didn't know who all these celebrities were. And for me, I think that was – a good thing. And I think most of the people there were not fixated on the celebrities.
Yeah.
I really did not. There was not this sense that, oh, yippee, there's Sammy Davis Jr. Oh, wow, there's Charlton Heston. That did not seem to resonate that powerfully. I think over the decades, the work that Harry Belafonte has done has, you know, really highlighted the work that he's, his work as an activist and his work as a really moral and a moral man of principles, high principles. But I don't recall people around us talking about the celebrities. We were talking about the speech. We were talking about the movement. We were talking about what had to be done.
Just a quick anecdote. I did a radio broadcast many years ago with Harry Belafonte from Lake Tahoe, and he was so fiery then in his speech, and he was actually fiery denouncing Bush 1, that I said, you missed your calling. You should have been a commercial talk show host.
He's still fiery.
The rhetoric was, whew. Let me go to Richmond, Virginia, and welcome another caller. Derek is joining us. Hi, Derek.
Good afternoon. And I just wanted to take this opportunity to say the march and the speech certainly paved the way for individuals like me to have opportunities that I'm not sure we would have had otherwise. I am a direct beneficiary of that work that some of you guys have done in civil rights, both economically, where I live, and all the opportunities that I have. But I will say that one of the most frustrating things for me in the business world today is that I've got counterparts who think that racism has somehow died in this country, and it hasn't. I mean, I've gotten some opportunities, but I've worked really hard to get into those opportunities. And I'm sure that there are some out there that I miss simply because of the fact that I'm an African-American man in America.
Derek, may I ask your age?
I am 41.
Because we keep hearing that young people don't see color as much.
I've got some coworkers, and I am one of those guys that, you know, I volunteer my time in the youth groups and things around the city. And I am single-handedly trying to convince the society that we need to continue the fight and to continue to change. But, you know, my counterparts would just assume that, I mean, I've heard it time and time again, you guys have every opportunity now to go out and succeed. But what's happened is it's just not as blatant as it was when some of our counterparts were fighting the fight. It's your application's in the trash, or it's, you know, you don't get that opportunity because you didn't know that person or you don't play golf. I had to change even the way I spoke to enter some of the circles that I'm in now. And I will tell you that it was a dramatic change from where I grew up in South Central LA. And it's just different. And I recognize the challenge, and I took it head on. And today I've had some limited success, and I'm very grateful for it, but I know where it started. And I am very grateful for what everyone has done in the past to get us this opportunity.
Well, congratulations on your success, and it's good to hear of your gratitude as well. I shouldn't say that someone in his 40s is a member of that younger generation, but we do keep, Cecil Williams, keep hearing about how young people just don't see color as much. And by young people, I mean maybe, you know, under 30.
Yeah, and I think one thing that often occurs is young people want to define their context. They want to define who they are and what they're doing and what they can do. And so, therefore, there may be clashes that occur knowingly or unknowingly of those who have achieved, of those who have been able to put things together, of those who are better, see themselves better than others who have not achieved. One of the critical things of young people, I keep hearing them say, is we want to be creative. We want to be ingenious. We want to do things on our own. Stop trying to take over or continue to take over what we're trying to do. And so I just got a feeling that if we don't think young, we better start thinking young. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we need to open up our all the baggage that you have. Need to open it up and pull out some of the stuff that's been there so long that it won't allow us the opportunity to go on with living life fully. And so young folks are more energetic, more committed, more musical, more dance type, more into things that have to do with humanity than those of us many times who are gripped by the past. The past can get us into serious trouble.
But I also think that young people see color differently because it's all up in their families in ways that it wasn't in our families. I mean, and there's more color. I mean, the country has become much more multicultural than it was 40, 50 years ago. So they see color differently. They operate around it differently. And they don't want it to be burdened by it. They don't want to buy into the pathology of that surrounds color. But at the same time, there are those who maintain a significant consciousness around what color means.
And we'll bring another caller on. That's you, Ron. Join us. Hi.
One of the really interesting things that I think hasn't gotten much coverage, I'd driven down from northern New Jersey. I was working in the UAW plant at the time. And that night when we drove back up at 9, 10 o'clock at night, most of that was a vast caravan of buses. I mean, it was just bumper-to-bumper buses going back up. And when you go up the New Jersey Turnpike, it's through the Pine Barrens where there's not a light for 10 miles in any direction. And I suddenly became aware that there were these crowds on the bridges that had gone out there at that hour of night just to cheer the buses coming back from Washington. I mean, these were people who couldn't get down there during the day, had to work or something, and they couldn't do anything else. And they just went out to stand by a freeway and cheer the buses coming back.
Well, thank you for that, Ron. Actually, dovetailing on that, I'm looking at an email from a listener named Mary Jo who says, 50 years ago, I was a West Coast college student working in D.C. as a summer intern in the then-new Peace Corps agency. During the day, I walked over to the mall and hung around the shadow as it was really hot and muggy that day of the trees lining each side of the reflecting pond in front of the Lincoln Memorial. People were everywhere, as photos have shown. Around me were groups of families and friends lounging on blankets with baskets of food, a very festive air. Everyone knew this was a special day. It was a happy, non-confrontational, easygoing crowd, and for me, a sheltered white gal, unforgettable, one of those events that forever sensitized me to the value of diversity. And Damon says, I was 9 years old and on a trip to Florida after Martin Luther King's speech, we were on some of the early sections of the new interstate highway system, and there were separate rest areas for coloreds and for whites, not to mention signs everywhere of coloreds only or whites only or separate signs and separate doors at businesses. Let us not forget that in the country Martin Luther King was talking about in 1963, we had our own version of apartheid in the South. Those buses, by the way, that she alluded to were cheered, and there was a lot of real celebratory feeling about them. Another listener writes, 50 years ago, I made the trek from Randolph, Ohio to Washington, D.C. It was the first of several trips I'd make to our nation's capital to protest, celebrate, and stand witness for change. As we celebrate the changes and face the challenges of the day, I want us all to remember the ongoing task is, quote, creating a more perfect union, a union that cherishes and respects all people, regardless of their gender, race, religion, politics, or social status.
May I mention, regarding the younger generation,
Michael Nolan,
we're having a free public celebration tonight at the African Senegalese restaurant, Bisab Baobab on 19th Street, and it'll be dance and music and spoken word, And I think I'm the only older person on the program. It's going to be younger people interpreting the 50th anniversary for their lives today and for their futures. So you're welcome to come
tonight. Open to the public.
Yep.
A lot of we've only got a couple of minutes left, but a lot of the confidence and momentum that was associated with the March on Washington, the whole civil rights movement, wouldn't necessarily have led to what it led to had it not been for one Lyndon Baines Johnson. It's hard to forget that as bad a president as he may have been in some of our minds with Vietnam, he was really responsible for pulling a lot of people out and manipulating them and making sure that legislation got through.
Well, he had some encouragement. He had people like Fannie Lou Hamer. You know,
this little light of mine.
Yes, her little light shone very bright. So it wasn't as though he came to this decision independently of anyone. There were people who were insisting and agitating. And I think also that he came to see that this really could be his great moment in history. And subsequently had a change of heart and mind, but that change and heart of mind was strategically directed by foot soldiers in the movement who were relentless.
Let us not forget those foot soldiers. I remember when a very memorable moment in my career interviewing Rosa Parks, and she even said, you know, I was just one person, just one of so many. And we have you three here today. Grateful for your work. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Cecil Williams, Michael Nolan, and Daphne Muse, all at the march 50 years ago. We also thank Kim Parker, who is with us from the Pew Research Center. And we thank you, our listeners. We're with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated in the evening. We're going to talk with a psychiatrist who is also a Buddhist in the hour ahead, who has written about the trauma of everyday life. He says you can get through it. When we return on Forum, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.